For thousands of years, so much of mantras have been chanted in this land. There is so much of energy here. That's why in India, people don't feel so much like going to the beach.
Did the deities come first or the mantras?
The thing is, the mantra is the deity. It is the energy.
You begin to open yourself up to mantras like Om Namah Shivaya.
And you won't believe, just people who have never done anything with any of this, you make them chant Om Namah Shivaya 108 times with the eyes closed. People come up and share such profound experiences.
Internally, when mantras become a part of your breath, they say you start looking like the deity, but what they're truly trying to say is that you're gradually becoming the deity, very gradually. How do you explain this?
Each mantra has its own specific quality, like we spoke about. The devata is the mantra. Like you said, those qualities will start manifesting more and more in you. For example, I think there was a saint at some point, he was such a devotee of the mother. At some point, he got breasts. So if that is possible, then for the mind and the emotions, definitely.
There's a reason that spiritual seekers from all over the world choose to travel within India for their own spiritual answers. One such spiritual seeker who's reached an advanced stage is our guest for today, the Dutch monk Swami Poorn Chaitanya. Today's episode is deeply therapeutic. It's a deep dive into the subject that we know of as Shiva. And it's one of those episodes that you'll remember as one of the iconic TRS episodes. So if you're someone who enjoys our spiritual genre of episodes, this one is special. It's Swami Poorn Chaitanya speaking to me about my favorite topic within the realms of spiritualism. It's all about Shiva today on TRS. Swami Poorn Chaitanya, welcome to TRS.
Pleasure to be here.
Are you ready for me to trauma dump on you?
We'll only one way to find out.
Whenever these spiritual podcasts visit my life, I usually need them to visit my life at that point, and I take something away from it. So I welcome conversations like this into my existence. Firstly, thank you for being in my house. Thank you for being in front of me. Thank you for your presence.
It's a pleasure.
How are you, sir?
I'm great. I mean, I feel great.
I have a lot of questions for you.
Bring it on.
It's a lot of personal questions. But maybe just so that the audience gets a little context, I'd love to know your Dutch name as well. I'd love to know about your story. I'd love to know how you're 25% Punjabi. So just break that down for the audiences before we dive deep into
sure.
this spiritual conversation.
So I was born and brought up in the Netherlands, in a place called Haarlem, which is near Amsterdam. My mother was half Indian. So her father was from India. She was born in Delhi and he was originally from Punjab. He came when the partition happened, when Pakistan became separate from India. He, with his brothers and sisters and his mother, came all the way to Delhi, built a life for them there. And at some point he got this interesting idea to come to the Netherlands for some time to learn how to make dairy products like cheese and baby food. And that is where he met my grandmother in a train. Somehow they got connected. Long story short, at some point they got married. She came to India with him. My mother and her brother were born there. But then when she was young, she came back to Netherlands with her mother. So she grew up there in the Netherlands mostly. She didn't speak any Hindi or things like that. But that makes her half Indian. And then when I was born, that makes me 25% because my dad was definitely Dutch. And then the name they gave me was Alexander. So that is the name I've used a big part of my life.
How do you explain to your friends in the West about what you do now? Or more specifically, how do you explain Sanatan Dharma, Hinduism, Shiva, these concepts, mantras, to your friends back home? Have you ever tried?
Yeah. I've spent the last 2 years more in Europe and I've actually done like big tours like Netherlands, UK, Denmark, Germany, so many places where I even conducted master classes on say mantras or secrets of karma, all these kind of topics.
Imagine I'm someone who's born and raised in Europe and I've never heard of these things. How do you explain all these things to me? Because my only perception of God is what I have heard since childhood. I've never even heard of Shiva, hypothetically speaking. Because the thing is, when you grow up in India, you take these things for granted. Oh yeah, Shiva. Oh yeah, Vishnu. Oh yeah, mantras. Yeah, yeah, we know what that is. That's because you're born in this culture. What about the people outside? How do you explain the 101 of this?
So, for example, when you talk about Shiva or any Devata, how I introduce it, that I say that, I tell them a little bit about the rishis, no? That in India, ancient times, they had sages, saints, who went into a deep state of meditation where their intuition became so clear that by taking their attention to something, the knowledge of that would unfold itself. And then I tell them, of course, this sounds a little abstract, but to give an example, you know, we have these scriptures on astrology, astronomy, Ayurveda, so much, where we have practical knowledge, where, for example, they spoke about the different moons of Saturn, even though our modern telescopes have only been able to physically confirm or perceive that in the last few decades. But then they realized that whatever was written in these scriptures is spot on, it's correct. They spoke about the world being round thousands of years ago. No, Bhugol. Even if you see some of these statues and descriptions where the Varaha avatar, you know, where Vishnu lifted the earth from the waters, this earth was round. And in the West, they only found out a few hundred years ago when you keep sailing and you don't fall off. You know, I mean, sounds very bad to put it like that, but to put it bluntly. So they had this knowledge of Ayurveda, of so many things, but that knowledge was downloaded, you can say, from the universal consciousness or from, it was intuitive knowledge. And so I said that they had this knowledge of how to go deep into meditation to clear their mind to such an extent that they were able to tap into that. And then when we talk about mantras and devatas, I said there are so many different types of mantras. The knowledge of mantras also came from the rishis. And to such an extent that the definition of the word rishi is a mantra drashta. No, it's one who has seen the mantra, who has perceived the mantra. It's not a mantra karta. It's not the one who has created it. So like how we had, people know this story maybe from school, Newton, no, and the law of gravity where he was sitting under a tree, one apple fell and he figured out. So Newton did not see something fall for the first time. Things keep falling all the time, even apples. He would have seen it so many times. But at that moment, if the story is true as it is told, he was sitting under the tree. He was chilling. He was very peaceful. He saw one apple fall down. And at that moment, his mind, his intuition was so clear that he did not just see the apple fall. He also saw that there is a principle behind it that is causing this apple to fall. And then he was able to work it out as what we now know as the law of gravity in physics. And because he was able to do that, now any of us can use that, and people are using it. So in the similar way, not exactly same, you could say that he was the rishi of the law of gravity, because he didn't create gravity. He didn't invent it, but he was able to perceive it so clearly and then share it in such a way that we can use it. Now, of course, in the Vedic scriptures also, they talk about gravity and all that already. That's a different thing. But the point is that the rishis were able to perceive these mantras in that state of meditation where they say, okay, these sounds have this kind of impact, definite specific impact on our body, on our mind, on the environment. And they shared that. And the beauty is that they said, okay, there is one universal consciousness or one substratum of this creation, but there are all kinds of vibrations. Now, if you look at string theory also, it's vibration, it's energy that is vibrating in so many ways. So these natural forces or these universal cosmic energies, they call it devatas. So they say a mantra invokes a certain energy or resonates with a certain frequency, and they call it a devata. And then you can have Ganesha or you can have Shiva, or there are so many. And then usually I explain a little bit about Ganesha, for example, that, you know, at some point they started depicting these devatas because it became a little difficult for people to relate to something as abstract as a cosmic energy. You know, in the ancient days, they had yagyashalas. They used to worship with mantras. They didn't have all the murtis and everything yet. The temples, the mandirs, as we see it now in those days, it was not the same. The rishis had yagyashalas. But then at some point for people it became very abstract, not just a mantra. So they said, okay, how to make a visual depiction of what this energy does? So if we say Ganesha, elephant head, well, one of the reasons is because it gives you that knowledge, awareness, that full awareness, all this knowledge. So to put all that knowledge and awareness, you need a very big head. Otherwise, it doesn't fit. Now, what is the biggest head you could find? Okay, elephant. No, there's no animal that was walking. Dinosaurs were gone already. So what has the biggest head? Okay, elephant. And there are many things, like it has a trunk, right? Ganesha has an elephant head has a trunk. And that has two functions. It's a karmendriya. It is something with which you can grasp, you can act, organ of action. It's also a jnanendriya. It's something with which you can perceive, you can gain knowledge. So where action and knowledge come together, move together, that is one of the things that Ganesha symbolizes. Because if you want to prevent obstacles or problems, or you want to resolve them, solve them, you need to have the right knowledge of what is the problem, what is the solution, but you also need to act. Because there are many people who know how things should be. They can keep complaining, government should do this, people should do that, but sitting at home and having all this knowledge is no good if you don't act. And some people will be very active, but if they don't have the right knowledge how to go about it, you can, you know, overthrow a dictator, but if there's no plan B, you get chaos, no? The situation becomes worse. So then you can explain to people that, okay, for example, if we make it very simple, Ganesha or Ganapati is that energy or is the mantra that kindles this quality in you where you get that broader understanding, the knowledge, as well as the right action to overcome your problems or to prevent them. So we've just touched upon a few things, but that way I explained that, you know, they had a beautiful way to depict it. So all these descriptions, and you've had podcasts with people who've spoken about it in detail, how even different forms of Ganapati, for example, represent specific aspects, whether he is standing, sitting, lying down, you have a Shakti Ganapati and so many things. And each of them is like a visual, you can say, user manual for those specific mantras, that those have been at least taught a little bit about these things. Just by seeing that description or hearing the description, then, oh, he's holding this kind of weapon, or he's sitting on this kind of vahana, vehicle, or he's having this kind of dress. They know exactly, okay, so this mantra can be used for this and this and this. This is what it will do.
Did the deities come first or the mantras?
So the thing is, the mantra is the deity. It is the energy. And the forms is what was revealed to the rishis. That's how they depicted it. But basically, because they say the devatas, they have a mantra sharira. Their body is the mantra. And in the Vedas, there is a nice story also where at some point they covered themselves with chandas, with the rhythm for the Vedic mantras, the intonation, because they wanted to hide from death. But then death is very smart. But the point there is that if you don't know the proper intonation, pronunciation, you cannot see the devata. No? That makes it complete. So the mantra, yes, the pronunciation has to be proper, intonation has to be proper. Then you get access to those energies. But then in the West, I tell people, so there are these different energies and we can use it for different purposes. And the beauty is that then usually one of the mantras that I feel is both very accessible and at the same time, which is very potent, is Om Namah Shivaya. So I explain to them some of the benefits of the mantra, how they can chant it. And then we chant together 108 times. I actually make them do that. And then...
Can you talk about the mantra?
Yeah. And then, but then they get the experience. You know, it's amazing. So what I usually explain to them is that, okay, why this mantra is so useful. And I go a little bit into Ayurveda, into Jyotish, into Vastu Shastra, because Na, Ma, Shi, Va, Ya. These five sounds are connected to the five aspects of Shiva that are known as the Pancha Brahma, his five faces. And these five forms of Shiva, they are called Sadyojata, Vamadeva, Aghora, Tatpurusha, and Ishana. Now, each of these aspects of Lord Shiva governs one of the elements, the Pancha Mahabhuta, that this creation is made up of. So I tell them that from the Vedic perspective, one way to look at this creation is that it is made up of these five elements in subtle form, combinations, permutations, including our body and mind. And these forms of Shiva are the Adhishtata, the ones that rule it. So through this mantra, what we do, we invoke these different aspects of Shiva, their blessing, to who govern these elements to balance it. And we add Om. Om is the sound of creation, the vibration of consciousness itself. So then you align those five elements with consciousness. It brings a harmony. And why is that so useful? Because practically speaking, if you look from an Ayurveda perspective, our body and mind is made up of these five elements, different combination, permutation. If you go to a good Ayurvedic doctor, they can tell you about any of your health conditions or problems or imbalance that, okay, this is an imbalance of these elements. And through this diet, through these lifestyle changes, through these treatments, we can balance them and then you are healthy. That is how you bring the health back. And we look differently because that combination is slightly different. We are a different cocktail. So you're born with a prakriti, with a certain constitution. And when you are in that balanced state, that is when you're healthy, when you're most effective, creative, peaceful. So we are all different. Now, if you look from a Jyotish perspective also, our chart is different. And a very good Jyotishi can look at your chart without even meeting you. Like, I can send him your chart. He has not met you. He doesn't know who you are. Based on that, he will tell you exactly what your Ayurvedic prakriti is, your constitution. That, okay, maybe you are Pitta Kapha prakriti, for example, and there may even be this imbalance right now, or you've had this and this problem. Why? Because when you were born, the way those planets stood in the sky was an indication of the quality of time itself at that point, which made a certain combination of these elements possible. And that has the effects that you will have this kind of body type, this kind of tendencies, whether it's physical, mental, emotional. But that way, it's all connected. So from a Jyotish perspective, if you look at the Navagraha, the nine heavenly bodies, you look at the zodiac signs, the Rashis, the Nakshatras, the stars. If you go a little deeper, it can all be brought down to those five elements. Different planets are connected to different elements, different aspects of those elements. So when you look at today, you will see, okay, there's all these things happening. And what is the final result that it has, the impact that time has on these elements right now? But we are experiencing that differently. You may be having a good time. I may be having a not so good time. But time is the same, no? Right now, the sun is in this place. The moon is in that place. So why are we having a different experience? Because you have your own constitution. You have your own karmic package of how these five elements are present in you. So if you have less fire in you, for example, and right now that fire is becoming stronger because of the effect of time, you may have more energy. You will feel better. You're more healthy. You're more dynamic. But if I already had a lot of fire, I'm a very pitta person maybe, and then that fire increases, I get burnout or I get really angry. So we are all unique. You have your own unique filter or your own unique combination of these five elements. So, I mean, I'm doing it in a nutshell now. So I explain to people that, so if you want to improve your health, physical, mental, emotional, there are many ways to balance those elements. One of the easiest is this mantra. Because that is what it does. If you want to improve the quality of your time, maybe right now you're going through a difficult time karmically, one of the best remedies from a Jyotish perspective is this mantra, Om Namah Shivaya. Even if you look at the space, you know, when we talk about Vastu Shastra or Feng Shui, an expert will come and you say, okay, maybe my office, you know, we keep having conflicts or some accidents or people keep falling sick or they're making a mess of things. Or maybe at home there's some issues. And you call an expert and they will look at it and they will see, okay, how are those five elements present here? Okay, maybe there's a washroom there, so that is water element, or in the northeast there is a puja place, or they look at all these things and they say, okay, based on that, what is the sum total, what is happening here? The energy may be flowing properly or not. And they may suggest, oh, you know, if you break a wall here and make a door, or if the entrance of your house is from that place, or if you make your bedroom in that corner, it will be better for you. There are some principles like that, so that energy flows more properly and you can use those elements to support your cause. Like you want to be maybe more healthy or more energetic. So again, it's those same five elements. But that is why if you have a good expert to look at your house, or, you know, because people, they're standard principles. You can go online. Okay, puja place should be in the northeast, whatever. Bedroom should be in that place. Kitchen should be in that corner. But this is the general stuff. Then you're not taking into consideration your unique package, because you are living there. So if you say Ranveer has a, you know, he needs some more fire element, for you it may be very good to have your bedroom in the place where the fire element is stronger, because that means in the morning you wake up more energetic. Or if that is your workplace, whole day you'll be much more productive. While for another person who already has a lot of fire, you stay away from there, because there if you go and sit and work, you'll keep getting angry at people. No? Too much fire. So it's very specific, it's very personal. But the beauty is then in such a complicated thing, if you want to balance the effect of the place, this is one of the best mantras. You travel a lot, maybe. I travel a lot, definitely. You stay in so many places, whether it's a hotel or this or that. Sometimes it may be a 5-star hotel, but the vibe is not great. I'm sure you've had this experience, no? You go to bed, you have all weird dreams. You can't help it because who knows what has happened there or what kind of place. Some places you go, you feel so nice. Say maybe you visited some ashram somewhere or some temple or some church and you just sit and you feel so peaceful. Or just a nice cabin in the woods, who knows. So place has an impact. But then what do? If you're somewhere where it's not great, maybe you can't change it. You have a mantra, you know? So I give people this, like an overview, and then I say, now let's experience. And you won't believe, just people who have never done anything with any of this, you make them chant Om Namah Shivaya 108 times with the eyes closed. We do it together. Then I guide a short meditation after that. People come up and share such profound experiences. And that is something, you know, that I really feel I've seen the same, whether it is with meditation, whether it is with yoga. This is really something that is for everybody. You know, it's not about that you have to believe in it. This is how it works. This is how mind works. This is how consciousness works, how the body works. And that way, there are no barriers. You know, we've had people coming to, say, you know, in our ashrams, say in Bangalore, our Art of Living ashram, and other places, sometimes we have a Rudrabhishek, for example, or Shivaratri celebration, Navaratri celebration. People come from all over the world, thousands of people, from Russia, Mongolia, US, South America, Africa, Europe. These people don't know Sanskrit. Forget about Vedic Sanskrit. Some of them don't even know English. Hindi, definitely not. They come, they sit there, they close their eyes, they listen to the chanting. Now we have the pandits chant the mantras and they go into deep meditation. And I remember for me, it was the same. The first time I came there, this was in 2004, first time I came to Bangalore, and there every Monday we have a Rudrabhishek. So they chant the Rudram Namakam Chamakam mantras and all of that. I just closed my eyes for a moment and for half an hour, I was gone. So these mantras, that sound vibration has that effect. You don't have to understand it, but it puts you in a deep state of meditation. It takes you to higher states of consciousness, which doesn't happen with other things. You can put Michael Jackson, Honey Singh, Britney Spears, Justin Bieber, whatever you want. You put it nicely, loudly, close your eyes and sit. You don't go into meditation. Something else may happen, but so there is something, you know, about this. And like, I mean, there are many things, but that has made me fall so much in love. Not just that, also that part recognition, but this ancient knowledge and this wisdom, you know, whether we call it Sanatana Dharma or the Vedic tradition, or it has so much power. And I've seen that also when you want to learn these things, because there may be many people who are keen to learn, many are seeking. I've seen whether it is Jyotish astrology, whether it is Ayurveda, whether it is knowledge of yoga, of Vedanta, Upanishads, or anything. If you have a proper teacher like a guru and acharya, and you have a parampara, you know, the tradition, that again takes it to a very different level. Because I've seen that this knowledge is so vast that, one, you can get, you need all the help you can get. But when there is a blessing of a parampara behind it, you know, when the guru is there or a lineage of gurus is there, that will carry you. And I've seen, because I meet so many people and sometimes they ask me, we have a conversation, you know, how in such few years you have learned so many things. You know, many things, even I don't know how, where it came from. You know, like you said, something will open up, or, but I've seen that when that parampara is there behind it, that really makes a difference. And if you see the scriptures everywhere, they say the same thing. Learn this from a guru, learn this from a teacher. Because they've only put some of the things. They don't put all the things. Some things you have to get through that. But it's not just the knowledge. It's the consciousness behind it that works. When someone is giving you the knowledge from their own experience, then it hits a very different chord. So, yeah.
I've spoken about this on the show earlier. But the first time I sat for an Om chanting meditation. Okay. So when you say the word, it has an impact on the environment, but it especially has an impact on your own body, on your mind, your throat box, your voice box, your soul. Eventually, and this is very Indian urban perspective, you begin to open yourself up to mantras like Om Namah Shivaya. Now imagine if saying Om loudly has this kind of an impact on the environment. If you're saying it silently, what kind of impact is it having on your internal environment? That's something you figure only through experience. Which is why, again, if you try finding the limitation in mantras, you'll become the limitation yourself.
Mm.
Just flow with it. Execute, experience it, and then come to your own conclusions.
But Om, you know, there is something interesting about Om, because especially when we talk about the Om Namah Shivaya, like this, the Panchakshari Namah Shivaya, this is actually, this is the what known as the Panchakshari. You know, it is a mantra with five aksharas. And then usually we add Om to it. But then Om itself is called the Sukshma Panchakshari. It also has five parts. So from Shiva, Lord Shiva, it said first Om came. He came, that it's one of his forms, that pure vibration, that pure consciousness. So you have the A, U, the Ma sound, and then there is the Nada and the Bindu. This is a bit technical for people, but there's five parts to it. But then they say that if you do the Japa of Om, especially the mental Japa, this is actually only recommended for people who are really ready to leave everything, including their body. So they say for anybody who is living, the mental japa of Om, 2-3 times is okay. But like proper japa, it's actually not recommended. They say you do Om Namah Shivaya. Because that, they say it will cut everything. So not just your worldly stuff, but everything, your body. And the thing is, you still need to eat, no? And I'm sure you want to eat at least something. So it's interesting, but it also shows how powerful, you know, how powerful.
I'm going to frame this question in a particular way, but obviously I'm asking you something deeper. Why is it that sometimes when you look at someone, you know that person is a Shiva worshipper? There's a commonality. And I see this with a lot of Shiva worshippers recognizing each other. And it's a stark difference from when you meet someone who worships Krishna. Both are positive. Mm. Both are positive in very different ways.
Yeah.
But at least with Shiva worship, was like the moment I saw you outside, I was like, ah, he's like me.
Apna.
A little sense of detachment. Mm. When I see a Krishna worshipper, they bring a lot of freshness and bliss with them. And I love being in their freshness and bliss. But with Shiva worshippers, there's a sense of mutual detachment from each other, from sansar in general, the environment. I do believe that when you chant mantras internally, when mantras become a part of your breath, they say you start looking like the deity, but what they're truly trying to say is that you're gradually, very
those
slowly,
qualities, yeah.
Yeah, you're becoming the deity very gradually. How do you explain this to the West?
Like you may be very successful now. At some point you'll die. At some point people will forget again, you know? So it doesn't mean you don't make a difference. But if you look from a bigger perspective, even this whole planet is a particle of dust. You know, we are really not that important. We think we're very important. But just like there are so many people crawling on this planet, you have so many bacteria in you. They die every day. They get born again. They may think they're very important, but we don't even know they're there. So Shiva has that kind of detachment. Now, a Krishna Bhakt, he will have a different flavor. No? A Devi Bhakt, again, will have a different flavor. And there are stories, you may have come across those as well, of saints and sages in this country, probably other parts of the world as well, who had such a strong devotion to one of the devatas that even physically their body started reflecting some of those qualities. Like, you know, where their body started even growing into that that form, where they started looking, like for example, I think there was a saint at some point, he was such a devotee of the mother. At some point, he got breasts, you know, like it just...
Ramakrishna Paramahansa.
Yeah, I mean, there are a few examples, but the same way, there are such stories where you can see that when it becomes so strong, so if that is possible, then for the mind and the emotions, definitely, you know. So to them, I explain it like that frequency becomes... And somewhere it's not so difficult to imagine, because if you talk about, you know, you have people around you who talk about investing all the day, all the time. Even if you never thought about invest, suddenly you may feel, oh, I should get some shares. Or if you have people talk about cricket all day long, you will start thinking about cricket, even though you never thought anything about it.
Yeah.
That's why Sangha is important also.
I don't think the world is in the best place, both mentally nor materially. By material, I don't mean just money. I mean material reality is not in the best place when it comes to the world. So I hope that people find healing through conversations like this, but it's just a hope right now.
You know, it's a time of transformation. And like we spoke, no, transformation is never easy. Change always comes with some pain. I remember about 10 years back, my master Guru Dev Shishir Ravishankar once, when someone asked him about, you know, maybe even more, 15 years or 20 years, that they said, no, 2012, they were expecting this big shift of spirituality. And then once he actually spoke about it, he said, you know, don't think that suddenly one day people will wake up and become spiritual. He said, what is actually going to happen is you will see there will be more natural calamities. There will be other conflicts. Economically, for some parts of the world, it will be very difficult. So he said, basically, what is happening is that all those things that people tend to rely on for their sense of security and stability will start shaking. And then when those things go, people will need to have something else to hold on to. And that's why even that time he said, no, we need to do whatever we can to share this knowledge, to be there for people, because if nobody's there to catch them, people will fall. And you see that now with pandemic, it was very obvious. People suddenly who thought that I'll never lose my job, I've been working there for decades, were let off. People who had a successful company may have to shut down. People who thought they're very healthy suddenly got scared, saying, even as a young, fit person, I may get this crazy what if I die? Or you may lose someone dear to you. There were so many things that started shaking. And I think that greatly contributed also to what we see now, that people realize that, you know, there has to be something more. Or they're waking up and realizing, whatever I was doing, this is not everything.
Because you've spent so much time in Indian villages and Indian metros, I'm sure you have an idea of what it's like growing up in India just based on what you've seen, or at least the mindset you've seen around you. So I want to ask you about what it's like growing up in India, according to you, versus what it's like growing up in Europe. What's the difference?
There's a lot of differences there. But what I've seen in India is that still, in many places, to a smaller or larger extent, this ancient tradition, you know, whether we call it the Sanatana Dharma or the local culture or whatever you want to call it, it's alive. And it may be decreasing in some places, in the sense that decreasing to the extent that people are exposed to it, they have access to it, but it's there. And in the West, like for example, in the Netherlands, we don't really have that anymore. You know, so many places in Europe, now some people are trying to get it back, or it's an attempt to reconnect with it. You know, whether it was the Scandinavian countries where they're reconnecting maybe to the whole Viking traditions and things like that. But in Europe, most of these places, that it's not a continuous link, you know, because at some point we had different tribes there. We had our own nature worship, or the different traditions, belief systems, some of them very ancient. But then at some point, you know, there was the Roman Empire that invaded. Then, of course, the Christianity came, the churches, a lot of the local customs were discontinued or discouraged. So we don't have that living tradition like that. Some people are trying to reconnect to it now because those are our roots, you could say. But here it's alive. You know, it's probably the most ancient civilization or tradition that has continued.
Do you feel that in Europe there is a lack of that feeling of ancientness? What you spoke about, the link being broken. Do you feel like young people on a subconscious level feel that? Because the narrative that we get about the West in general, which is Europe and America, yeah, while we're sitting here as Indians, is that mental health issues are on a rise there. And then I have some European friends who have spoken about this too. A lot of them believe that maybe because people have kind of stopped having faith in religion or a sense of God, atheism has kicked in a big way. That could be a reason. I don't know. I'm not European. I've not grown up in Europe. In fact, I don't even know the reality of modern day Europe, because vacationing is one thing, yeah, but when you live there and you grow up, that's a whole other experience. So what's the reality of Europe now from a mental health, emotional health and spiritual health standpoint?
Well, all over the world, mental health and emotional health are a challenge now, even in India, but there even more, definitely. And I think one of the factors is, one, culturally, that people are more and more isolated, I would say. You know, it's very individualized. Like, of course, even here nowadays, not everybody has an extended family where you all live in the same house and like it used to be. But still, the connections are much stronger here. You know, you're not just an island by yourself.
It's community living.
Yeah, it's much stronger. So there, that is much less. So it's not that people don't meet, but you live by yourself. You know, even when you go to college, you move out and then normally you don't move back in. So whether it's 18, 19, 20 years, then you say bye. You may visit your parents once a week or once in a while, but you know, that's kind of it. And then obviously when, you know, you're more thrown back onto yourself, then it depends also, okay, how much do you go out and meet people? How much do you interact? But also the spiritual aspect or the religious aspect, it may differ a little from country to country. But for example, in the Netherlands, I think hardly anybody is really religious in the sense, like if you say when I was in high school, how many of the people in my class of 30 people would go to church even once in a while? Maybe one.
Really?
And that was because their parents would take them, you know, and they're not interested. So churches, for example, are empty.
But what's the sense of God then?
So the thing is, it's not that people are like total atheist or, you know, they just want to, you know, like have food, make merry and that's it. But I would say there is definitely a large growing sense of, you can say, spirituality. So it's not that people are not exploring, but there definitely has become, there's a bit of a vacuum or that people are aware of, they're trying to fill. It's just that the old ways of religion, whatever was there, cannot cater to it anymore because they feel, okay, even if some guy is talking something there, he doesn't have an experience, you know. If I want to read some book, whether it's a scripture or something else, I can do that at home, you know. So why would I go and sit there? So that disconnect is there. Like, it's not the same, but here, for example, sometimes even, you know, like youth come to me and they have an interest. They have the big questions, actually more maybe than even before. So they want to know, okay, who am I? You know, what is all this? Why am I here? What is the purpose of life? What is this creation? But then if their parents or grandparents will tell them, come, you have to come to the mandir. And then if they ask, okay, but then what is the point? Why should I break one coconut? Now, if their family cannot give satisfactory answers, it's natural for them to say that, kya fayda yaar? No, why should I do that? I will explore in my own way, you know, because I want to know. So there also, if you see whether it is yoga, whether it's meditation, whether it's ayahuasca, or whether it is, you know, people doing some program on mindfulness, or they want to learn more about chakras or Buddhism, or like there is a lot of interest. And with pandemic, that spiked even more, you know. So many people, they are asking these questions. They want to know. They want to know, okay, who am I, or what is this, or I'm not just this body, or maybe not even just these thoughts and these emotions. So that's very strong. But yeah, from a religion perspective, that is not really being catered to.
Maybe different geographies have different impacts on your thought process. That's one thing I truly believe. I feel like if you're in this land called India, like this subcontinent, your head automatically trails to deeper thoughts like the universe or God. And a lot of Indians don't understand that until they actually go abroad and understand the difference between energies of lands.
Definitely. See, a place has its own energy and vibration, whether you take a local place or an entire country. And I know so many people from not just from Europe, from other parts of the world who have shared this with me or agree with me when I said that, you know, you can say, okay, when you come to Delhi, maybe the air is not as fresh as it may be in Switzerland. You know, there will be some pollution. It may be more noisy. I mean, it will be more noisy, you know. Sometimes it may not be as clean or as organized. But still, the moment you get off the plane and you come there, on a subtle level, something feels so much lighter, you know. So that subtle air or environment or space, whatever you want to call it, is so much lighter, like you said. And the thing is, I remember once someone asked my master about, you know, something around this topic. And he said, you know, because for thousands of years, so much of mantras have been chanted in this land, and you know, you've had the rishis and everything, that even today, on the subtle level, there is so much of energy here. And he said, that's why in India, people don't feel so much like going to the beach. Because if you see abroad, people love going to the beach. Why? Because that salty water, no, on a subtle level, it clears your aura, it clears your mind. So you feel lighter. No, people go to the sea to feel lighter. But here, because that energy is so strong everywhere, you don't feel a need to go to the sea especially. Here you can sit in any, whether it's a local temple or maybe even your terrace. And of course, when you go to special places, like, you know, whether it's a Jyotirlinga or an ashram or, you know, a place where that energy is even stronger, you just sit there and you don't even have to do something special. Even if you say, I don't know how to meditate, no problem. You just go and sit there that place will have an impact. No? Like we spoke about that, are there different things that impact our mind? Are the quality of your thoughts? One of them is the place. So a good place will have a very positive impact.
The message I keep trying to put out through this podcast was started from a place of a lot of love. Every single episode intends on packing healing and then sending it out to the world. So there's a lot of good intention, which is why I think this room feels happy and nice. But, you know, there's a part of me that's like really, I'd say it's like fallen out of love with not just podcasting, not just my career or materialism, but with life. I don't know why. And I don't even think it's a bad thing. I think I'm getting deeply detached. I've not felt this detached in my life ever. I've just submitted to God now. And I'm focusing a lot on my practice. That's it. Then letting God like act through me. My only prayer to God often at night is, do your work in this world through me. That's it. But this sense of detachment is also causing some pain on the inside. I don't even know why.
It has to. Because for any change to happen, any change, you know, we have to let go of something. And that is always painful, you know. Even if it's something that is not good for us, still to let it go for our mind, it is painful. You know, you sometimes see old people that have lived in a house for, say, 50 years. And now the place is, it's a dump, you know, it's leaking. There's so many problems, but they don't want to move. You tell them, like, maybe, you know, your parents or some, like someone will tell their parents that, come, I got a nice other place for you, or at least that till we fix this up. But they don't want to, because that's what they know. So like you said, sometimes we go through phases in life where we may, you know, accumulate habits that are not good for us, or people around us that are not good for us, or it could be anything, or even just mental conditioning that's not good for us.
Mental conditioning that's not good for us.
But because we know it, to let go will be painful. You know, it sounds very strange, but you can get used to and even start liking being depressed or being angry or being so frustrated.
Enjoying the wounds, not letting the wounds heal.
Yeah, it's a kind of enjoying. It's not real joy. So what you're saying makes total sense. And if you, like one of the most beautiful scriptures I have read multiple times, which is the Yoga Vasishta, there it starts with Lord Rama coming to this point where he got these realizations where he said, okay, you know, as a prince, he's experienced so many things. This is before he got married and all of that. But then he comes to a point where he becomes so dejected because it's like, what is the point? You know, all of this, it's temporary. Even these pleasures are temporary. Then I'm back to square one. So this is not going anywhere. So it is that point where you start seeing the impermanence or the futility of what you know as the pleasures or the goals that you're supposed to strive for and all of that. But you've not yet come to the point where you can fully consciously experience that joy and fullness of consciousness itself, of the self. And then Vasishta, the guru of the family, he comes and he starts giving him the knowledge of the self. So if you haven't studied it, it's something that you must read. I can recommend a good, very beautiful translation. But it's so beautiful to see how step by step he takes him to the point that, okay, what is the nature of the mind? What is the nature of the self? You know, how are they different? And then this whole world, how to make sense of this duality, because it's relative. It's not absolute. But at the same time, we are experiencing it. So how do you bridge this supposed gap or apparent gap between duality and non-duality?
It's very tricky. Duality and non-duality. What is the duality in the first place?
Well, everything here, what you see, if you feel that I am separate from this, or there is not just me, that is duality. That means there's two or more than two.
You and something else.
And non-duality is that it is, in the end, it's all one. So Adi Shankaracharya, the Advaita Vedanta, Advaita means the non-duality. So where he said that Brahma Satya Jagan Mithya Jivo Brahmaiva Napara, which means that this whole world that we see appears, but is not really. And what is really permanent, what is truth, is Brahman. It's one consciousness, one universal consciousness. And the Jiva, the individual consciousness, the self, and the universal consciousness are actually not separate. So he explains it very beautifully, saying that, say, you go out at night and you know, you go down a path and then you think there's a snake. Now you get scared because, you know, what if the snake bites you? So you stop. You have a small lamp with you. You think, okay, let me wait for the snake to leave first. But then your heart is beating and you're very scared and, oh, what will happen? Will I be okay? And then suddenly from behind someone else comes and say your sister comes with a bigger lantern. And the moment she comes closer, because the light is more, you realize, oh, it's not a snake, it's a rope. So there was a rope lying there. Someone would have left it, but it looked like a snake because the light was less. The moment you see it's a rope, that fear is gone, everything is fine. Yeah, thank God, you know. So he says this world, this whole whatever we experience, including your body and your mind and your limited identity, it's like that snake. You think it's there, but it's not really there. But then you cannot say that, oh, there was nothing there. No, there was a rope that made you think it was a snake. The same way he says, it's not that there is nothing. No, there is consciousness. But we experience it as being different in so many ways. And this is a topic for lifetimes, you can say, because all the great masters and saints have spoken about it in different ways. But the more you start experiencing that, yes, on one level, really, this is all, it's all one. You know, whether it is all me or whether it's all him or it's all the Shakti or whatever. No? Different people approach it in different ways, how you connect. But in the end, that it is one thing. And then the beauty is, the more that comes in, then you start also being able to appreciate everything as a form of that. Like I was in Rishikesh a few days back. I had brought one group from Europe. And there was a break, a few hours, I let them, you know, whatever, someone wants to go shopping or take a dip in the Ganga, whatever you want to do. So I had a little time for myself and I was just walking. And there was a moment where suddenly, I wasn't thinking about it, but that thought came up again that, you know, it's so amazing how all of this is a manifestation of that one divinity. You know, they say, Sarvam Shivamayam Jagat, it's all Shiva. And the moment that came, and then I was looking around and you see maybe some, you know, some trash is lying there on the road. But that's also Shiva. You see one cow is coming. That is also Shiva in a different form. You see a guy selling something. The same thing. And then even that trash, you're able to appreciate. And it's amazing how that one thing is manifesting in such a diversity. And that's beautiful.
I want to say a few things. Firstly, I want to say that this is not a conversation for everyone. There's lots of people who've tuned out.
Yeah.
And only for the ones meant to hear this will the information truly sink into the mind. I remember once I was telling a friend of mine to read Autobiography of a Yogi, and she was a very fiery person, you know, doing well in her career and very headstrong. And I felt like she had a spiritual bent of mind. So I gave her the book. She started reading it and then she put it down after a few chapters. So I asked her, why'd you put it down? And she said that because in that book, the writer has constantly referred to God as a he.
Okay.
How does he know that God is a he? And I accepted that feedback. I was like, okay, that's her conditioning. That didn't even strike me when I was reading the book. I was just looking at God as a genderless being, which you refer to as God. I never thought about why I call it he or she calls it she, etc. Eventually in life, I realized that it's all our mental conditioning that stops us from allowing the depths of what's being said to enter your mind, which is why they say that when you read scriptures at different ages, different aspects of those scriptures will enter your head. Because as you age, you're letting go of your mental conditioning in many ways, which is why the
process, hopefully
that's how it should be.
Yes.
Your one's own pace.
But you know, it's not even just the spiritual knowledge entering you. If you really look at it, like I have a great love and passion for mantras from a very young age. But one of the most, I would say, beautiful things that mantras can do for you. Like I know you also love mantras and you've spoken about, you had different people, wonderful people come and share about mantras in the podcast. That it says in the scriptures, manana trayate iti mantra. The mantras are those sounds or vibrations that by repeating them, they can take you beyond the mind. They can transform your mind. But why is it? Because this conditioning, you know, when we talk about karma, you know, it's a very abstract things for people maybe, but these are the seed impressions. But then you say, okay, so from past lives or whatever, you've taken some of this conditioning with you. But then how does that affect your life? You go to an astrologer, they'll say, oh, probably this is happening, or that was happening, or this will happen. But how is that? That doesn't, you know, it's very strange. How can these impressions in your consciousness affect your life like that? Because that conditioning that we carry, in the end, that is the root cause for the thoughts coming up, the qualities of the thoughts coming up. So say you're a very intuitive person, you're extremely smart, and you're very blessed that out of 10 choices, you will always make the best choice. No? Let's say you are like that. Now, I give you 10 options. You will choose the best one. But if all 10 are different types of poison, you will choose the best one, but you still end up with poison. And if someone is a total, well, forgive my language, but an idiot, like he's really not smart, he's very unlucky, he will always choose the worst option. But if I give him 10 different types of cake, nice pastry, he will take the worst one, but it's still nice pastry. So if you look at your life, anybody, you know, we act on our thoughts. You get a thought, and that is why you do an action. Now, when you become more aware, of course, spiritual practices really help with that. Your awareness increases. You start having a choice that, okay, do I want to act on this thought or not? Some people are on autopilot. Whatever thought comes, they will do it. Then you become more aware. Then you say, okay, is this a good thought or not? Is this something that I want? Like right now, I feel like slapping this guy, but I'm not going to do it because either I lose my job or it's not good or whatever. I feel like eating 10 pizzas, but I know it's not good. Let me not do it. I may want to stay up all night binge watching this thing on Netflix, but I know I have to work tomorrow. I have an important presentation. So maybe only till 2 o'clock, you know? So you have a choice whether you do it or not, but you still only have a choice between the thoughts that are coming up, you know? So somewhere there is something that has prompted you to say, okay, I want to become an engineer, or I want to do a podcast, or I want to do this or that. And where are those thoughts coming from? You cannot change a thought before it comes. So if you really want to gain more freedom, if you want to have better options, then maybe the really only and best way is to change the quality of your thoughts. And that is where mantras come in, because mantras can change the quality of your thoughts. It can change your conditioning. And that is how, say, you know, someone may have been doing a mantra for some time. So suddenly they start getting different type of thoughts, different quality thoughts. So your options have improved. So like I said, even if you have 10 options and you choose the worst one, if they're all good, that'll take you in a good direction in life.
Let me have a go at this for people who want to understand this with a little more depth. Okay, I'm sure. Trying to talk to my podcasting audience. I have a friend of mine, a mentor. He's also created a lot of series on Level Supermind. His name is Om Dhamatkar. And I've learned a tremendous amount from him. One of the earliest things he told me was that the process of meditation creates a larger distance between thought and perception. So thought is the sentence that comes up. Oh, I want to go to sleep. Oh, I want to hit this guy. Oh, I should be doing this in life. You don't know where it's coming from. Perception is like another person inside your head who's looking at those thoughts and then acting upon them or judging them and figuring out what to do. So when you're a child or when you're an animal, there's no distance between the thoughts and the perception. Get a thought, you act upon it.
Yes.
Tiger sees prey, tiger jumps. You know, a child sees a toy, tiger goes towards the toy. And then as you grow older, usually there's a little distance created where you're able to see your own thoughts.
Yeah.
And then as you become more street smart, probably that distance increases. When you meditate, that distance increases tremendously.
True.
When you get into practices, it increases even more. But what I've never thought about until this conversation is about the origin points of those thoughts. They're coming out of what in my head I visualized as some dark pit.
True.
They're coming out of somewhere. And then that person in my head, which I call perception, looks at those thoughts.
Exactly.
So you're saying that when you actually get into deeper practices, that dark pit that those thoughts are coming out of actually becomes more fertile to throw up more interesting things at you.
Yeah, exactly. And it will help you burn the stuff that's not good for you. You know, like if we talk about spiritual practices, you know, you're being able to burn some of the mantras even before they sprout, you know, the seeds before they sprout. And that is how these practices are so valuable, invaluable, I would say. And, you know, it's very interesting. I've seen people sometimes, you know, they say they come with a problem, that they're having a health problem. they've been to so many doctors, and then, you know, they're just not able to figure out what's wrong with them, and they tried so many things, and then they went to a good astrologer, Jyotishi, and they found out, okay, you know, this is some part of your karma, no, you're facing, but there is a remedy. There is a mantra you can chant. Do this mantra, it will help you. Now, this person, he was not into spiritual stuff at all, but he was like, you know, I've tried everything. I may as well give it a shot. So it's not like he was sitting there with full devotion, but he did it every day. Now, after 1 or 2 months, this friend of mine, the astrologer, he called up this person and he asked him, like, how are you now? He said, actually, I'm doing great. He said, oh, tell me what happened. He said, oh, it's because not because of the mantra, but you know what happened? After 2 weeks, after I spoke to you, a friend of mine said that he knows a good doctor, and I thought, okay, I may as well go and see him. And I met this person, and he just saw me, and he analyzed the reports, and then he figured out exactly what was wrong, and it was a very simple thing. He gave me some food supplements and things like that, some vitamins, and my problem is gone now. Now, what this person did not realize is that, you know, if we say, okay, there are certain mantra you can do as a remedy, that doesn't mean you just do the mantra and your problem gets sorted. What it does is that mantra will take away those karmas when done in the right way. And when that karmic block is gone, life will start flowing. So the thing is, for 2 years, he was meeting different doctors. Now, why suddenly he came across this guy, and that guy, that doctor, had the right thought at that moment where he saw this is your problem, and he gave him the medicine. So that is why it's difficult for people to imagine, but this conditioning, not just in us, but even in the world around us, when you're able to change, then suddenly it's like, you know, you've done so many job interviews and suddenly you end up in the right place. Or suddenly people will feel you are the right person. You know? So on a subtle level, there's this whole thing going on, and the spiritual practices, like mantras, which are very specific, of course, they have an impact on that level. Otherwise, you can do all the effort you do, but no, you may be unlucky. You may end up in the right place, but you're just too late. They just hired another guy for the position, you know? And that is why, even if you see, like in India, of course, still there is this practice, still many people do, of Namakarana. You know? Like you choose a name for the child, not just because you like it or because it was your grandmother's name, but they take the chart, or they go to a pandit or an astrologer, and then they will usually suggest, you know, okay, you start a name with this sound. You know? That is a common practice. Why? Because our name is like the first mantra diksha. It's the first mantra you receive, because this is the thing that you keep thinking about. You keep telling people. People keep calling you that. So if that is chosen wisely, that can be tremendously beneficial, because the right mantra, the right name, can make sure that you're not just healthy, but you are successful in society. People respect you. You know, your body is strong. And in ancient times, not even in India, even in other parts of the world as well, in many cultures, there was this practice that if a child, when they're very young, keeps getting sick, you know, they have a lot of health problems, they would start questioning that maybe they were not given the right name. And sometimes they will change the name and you will see a drastic improvement. But the thing is, like with many of these practices now, like what you're also doing with the podcast, is how do you make people aware of the quality stuff? Because meditation also, every street corner now you can learn something, doesn't mean it's really meditation. So with this Namakarana, what I've seen is that usually what they do, they take the birth star, you know, like your Janma Nakshatra. And based on that, there are some letters. They say, okay, start your name with Va, Vi, Vu, or something like that. That's what most people do. Because people ask me also, can you help me with a name? Or a pandit suggested this, is it good? The thing is, if we look at those in ancient times also that had access to the top-notch astrologers, no? Let's say we take Lord Rama, no? Sri Ram. Now, his name was given by the family guru, Vasishta himself, no? Brahma Rishi, grandfather of Parashara, one of the greatest Jyotishis. Now, Lord Rama's nakshatra was either Pusha or Punarvasu, and based on that, there are some letters that come. It's like Ka, Ko, Ke, and then Ha, He, Hu, like there's a bunch of them. Ra is not there. So that means they followed something different. They didn't follow this principle, no? And he was he had so much knowledge of Jyotish and all of this knowledge. If we look at Sri Krishna, you know, his name was given by Gargamuni, again a great rishi. Now, his nakshatra was Rohini. Now, there also the options are Va, Vi, Vu, O. It's not R or Kr. So again, he followed something different. Jawaharlal Nehru, for example, his name was given by the Raj Jyotishi of Khetri that plays there. So again, very knowledgeable person. For him also, a different thing was followed. So then if you go deeper into this, I've also started learning, it's very interesting. But then you see that they look at many other things. So if you just take that one letter based on the star, it means it will make your body strong and you'll have enough food to eat if you do it right. Doesn't mean you won't have health problems. Just means you'll survive. Doesn't mean you'll have a good place in society. Doesn't mean you'll be happy necessarily. Doesn't mean you'll spiritually advance. They say if your name can be one of the names of your Ishtadevata, then nothing like it, because that is the form of God or that universal consciousness that will take you towards mukti, towards liberation. It will take you out of bondage. So then whatever you do in life, at least you will not be going further into bondage. You'll be more free. You know? So these are things that when you think about it, it's amazing. So that mantra, your name, if it is chosen correctly, that itself can be such a blessing. And in this, I'll not even say country, this subcontinent, you know, this Bharat, they had this kind of knowledge with these sanskaras where they say, okay, at every important intersection of your life, you know, where there is a transformation, whether it's you getting a name, the first time you're eating the food, you know, anaprashan they call it, when you get married or when you start your education, if it's done in the right way, it can, they say it increases the sadhak tattva, it will help you to progress further, it will support your journey, and it will remove the badhak tattva, it will remove the obstacles. And the goal was self-realization, freedom, full blossoming of the potential of human existence, of our consciousness. So when you consciously do those things, it makes all the difference. And that is also why I feel it's so beautiful that this knowledge is in many ways becoming a little more well-known now. There are so many people who want to know about it, because it's not just for India. The whole world needs these things if people want to be happy, healthy, successful, and get along, you know.
Swamiji, this was the end of the podcast. Thank you. Great talking to you. I really needed to meet you today and hear what you had to say, because I was feeling very anxious, afraid. I've been thinking about, not wishing for it. Again, I don't know where the thoughts are coming from, but I've been thinking about an earlier peaceful death a lot. And I've been wondering why I've been thinking about an earlier peaceful death. Because in my head at one point, I thought I'd live till the age of 100 at least. And now I've started to visualize myself passing away at 37 or 38. But sometimes when I meet people like yourself, I understand that visualization to probably be a passing away of a sense of ego and a sense of self. And maybe transformation rather than just death, which is always the motive behind any of these episodes. We're trying to spread the message called transformation. So thank you, Swamiji. Thank you for collaborating with us on Level Supermind. Like, honor to be professionally collaborating with you as well. It's a lot of power that we put in each of those guided meditations. So the fact that you've put your own prana into that app means a lot to me, that we've been able to kind of collaborate on some front. I hope to speak to you again on the show. And I hope that you had a fun time speaking to me.
Definitely. And I wish you all the very best with this beautiful initiative. And it was sometimes deeper than I had anticipated in a good way. And I hope it may help many people to explore a little further. Yeah, what our true potential is.
Yeah. They say that if you take one step towards God or evolution, then God or evolution takes 10 steps towards you.
Definitely.
So it's just about moving in the direction of practice.
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you, Swamiji.
Namaste.
Ladies and gentlemen, that was the episode for today. The Dutch monk will be going through the comment section of this particular podcast. So make sure you send in your questions, your requests, and your feedback for the next time that he's recording an episode of TRS with us. Shiva's one of those infinitely deep topics that we can keep exploring, that we can keep learning about together. And the fact that I get this opportunity to ask my own questions, to go about my own spiritual seeking in front of you all, is one of the greatest privileges of my life. This is something I can do forever. I can't believe that I get to call this a profession. So days like this are a little extra special for me, a little extra enriching for me, and a little extra wholesome for me. I hope you feel the same emotions for all these spiritual episodes of TRS. We're going to link our spiritual playlist down below. Make sure you go check that out if you liked today's episode. And for more episodes just like this, keep following The Ranveer Show. Ranveer and the team will be back very soon. Om Namah Shivaya.